This week's episode has a trigger warning for potentially upsetting subject matter. Check the show notes at www.bitchesoncomics.com to find out more.
Welcome to Bitches on Comics. I'm your host, Essie Fleenor.
I'm Sarah Century. Sorry, I was just taking a drink of beer. And,
what an intro.
All right. I'm Sarah Century. It's nice to meet everybody. Today we have a very special guest.
Oh, that's me. I'm the special guest. My name is Thuy Nguyen. I am very Vietnamese. You can call me Thuyet Nguyen. We just had a very long discussion about my name and why I say it two different ways. When I was really young, I decided to pronounce my name phonetically because it was easier, because it was sort of explaining to people how to say my name was just too much engagement with strangers, and I just didn't want that. So I sort of opted to do it a little easier. But now that I'm older and the discussion of sort of pronouncing names correctly and sort of, I think now that it's sort of like in the sphere, I feel like I should try to explain more. Or maybe I'm just sort of, I've just been thinking too much about the fact that I just let people say my name wrong all the time, even though I'm very comfortable with it. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I mean, no, but, you know, definitely yes, right? Like, I get that it seems like it's something that I would probably think about constantly as well.
Right, because I don't mind being called Thuyet. I think it's very fun. I think it's real cute. I'm real used to it. It's very easy on everybody. But there's a part of me that dies a little bit every time because I'm like, oh, that's like, but like not really how you say it. But it does make me very excited when I meet other Vietnamese people who say my name correctly to me. That's a that's a different kind of thrill that I cannot get anywhere else.
So I know you because you were the manager of a band for a very long time, and you have a book out about this.
Yes. Yes. I tour managed this band, Deer Tick, for a long time, actually up until very recently. And I did write a real short kind of tour diary book. There was a tour diary at the beginning of it and then some personal essays just about being on the road with this band for the first 2 years that I was with them.
Yes. Who put that book out?
I did, actually. I just self-published this book. I had a little press going for a minute, which I no longer have. And so that was just me with the band, I should say. Like, I didn't fly by night, write
just
this,
here as
like,
a guest.
Story about them.
We will help you figure out what to add, what you need, information you got to get across. That is what we're here for.
Can you still get this book?
No, it's actually all sold out.
Wow. Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks.
That's amazing.
Thank you. I feel really good about it. And it's like, I feel like I've gotten a lot of great feedback from it, and it's, the band really loved it. It's called, Nothing Without Providence. And it's something that I'm really proud that I did. And it is sort of too bad that you can't get it anymore, but also, you know what? You should have been there when it was available. That's not my
That's
fault.
That's on you, audience.
I love that. A whole different approach to book sales. Fuck you.
It's gone. You cannot have it. It was here at a time, and you should have been there.
Suck it.
Yes. Well, obviously it worked because they all sold out. So also you do another thing currently, which you can find very easily, which is a podcast where you talk about horror films.
Yes. I am one of two hosts on Bunk 237, horror movie podcast. It is me and my friend Robin, and we just gab about horror movies. It is very, very fun. There's a lot of laughter. We're very silly, and we just love horror movies so much, so much. And Sarah, you were recently on, and that is coming out in a few weeks.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure actually by the time this goes live, because when is this going live, Essie?
So it's actually going to run at the end of this month, April 28th.
Oh, is it? Oh, the 28th? Oh my God. So it will be just literally the day before,
yeah.
Right?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
Incredible. Great timing. I'm really glad that this all worked out.
Someone was, we just had an episode come out, but we had recorded it before Sarah had guessed it on the other person's podcast. And so someone was like, I got really confused. And I was like, listen, this podcast is exactly like comics. We do not care about continuity. Good luck. You know, like, what? Who knows? You could enter here, enter there. Who knows what we're talking about? I barely know. So you're no longer managing the band. So what is, you know, is the podcast the main focus? Are you doing more writing? What's going on for you right now?
I still work in music. I still tour with bands, except for currently not right now.
Right now, yeah.
Right now is sort of a dead space for touring. It feels weird because I'm kind of just waiting around until live shows come back so I can go back to work. I still do a lot of production for live shows, which is my main job, which is kind of just a glorified babysitter, and I just order food for people is what I say. It's a lot of logistics and setting up things backstage and a lot of planning and kind of dealing with tour buses and catering and green rooms, etc.
That sounds fun and sometimes stressful.
It is both. Yes. Extremely fun. I do get to like travel the world and hang out with my friends, and that rules. But it is, my job in particular is honestly like very stressful. I'm working 24 hours out of the day. I sort of have to, you know, I take care of everyone as part of my job. It's sort of like my job is to sort of like handle everything so that everyone else can do their jobs. So just sort of making sure everyone's like fed and slept and they know where they're going and, you know, everything that they need is where they need it to be. Like, that's my job. And so it is sort of a lot of taking care of adults.
So important, though.
I'm like, I need so much care.
Yeah, I am unfortunately like really good at it. Really good at remembering stuff for you. Do you know what I mean? Just sort of like, don't forget the thing before you go on stage, even though you do the same thing every day, but somehow you forgot like your guitar. I don't know. You know, stuff like that. That's me. That's me, right behind the scenes.
I love that.
My therapist told me that she gets frustrated that people think of adults as different than children, when really we're just babies who got really tall. And I think that that connects to your job.
I want you to know that that absolutely connects with my job. I work with a lot of musicians, and like, God bless them, but wow. Like, just, they are... Yeah, real. There's so helpless sometimes with real basic shit. But I think it's sort of like, you know, the idea, it's like, oh, if you're really good at this thing, like say, like writing songs, maybe you're not great at remembering where you left your phone, you know? Mm-hmm. But that's why I have a job.
This reminds me of me and SE, because I am bad at time and schedules, and SE is a Virgo rising, and so they are way more
say,
on
very
top of
anxious
it.
Very yes. anxious.
I mean, Virgo rising, same difference. Like,
I'm bringing that to therapy next time I talk to my therapist. Right, it's not me, it's Virgo rising. Like, excuse me, what are you talking about? I don't know anything about zodiac really, or like horoscopes and stuff, but Sarah tells me a lot of things. So now I just use what I know as a weapon. And I'm just like, I can't do that. I'm a Taurus. And someone's like, excuse me. And I'm like, no, that's just facts. These are called facts.
It's
I'm sorry.
That's
how
it is.
Oh my gosh. Well, we're super pumped because we invited you on the show and you were like, yes, I'm in. Now I want to talk about these two films. And I'm super pumped by the films you chose. The first one is Let the Right One In from 2008. It's noted as like a horror romance. I want to talk about that. Then there's also I Care a Lot, which is a brand new 2021 release from Netflix. So I'm pumped. Where do you want to start? I mean, I can't wait. I'm like, let's talk about it.
What I was going to say is that whenever you brought this up, it wasn't necessarily as let's do a double feature. It was just you being like, I like Let the Right One In. And also, I just watched I Care a Lot. And I was like, oh, we should just do a double feature. And you were like, ah. And because they're two very different movies, right? And so after a while, I thought about it, though, and I was just like, oh, it's totally just about queer villains. That's like what we're talking about, right? Is like complicated, weird queer villains.
that's the connecting theme, I guess.
Yes, that is the exact summation of what happened. it was funny because when you asked me to come on, I had also been like, well, I don't know if I know enough about comics. Like, I don't know if I'm enough of a comics fan. And you're like, oh, that's fine. We can just talk about movies. And then later when I thought about it, I was like, oh, but I guess, like, I don't know. Like, I really like Chris Ware, and like, I read most of The Walking Dead, and I've seen, like, I've read all of Blade of the Immortal, all like 30 something books of that, and watched like the animated series twice, and saw the live action thing. And I just like kept in my head, like, thinking of every comic book I've ever read. And I was like, oh, wait, I guess I could have suggested that. But that's
what I'm hearing is we need to have you back.
That's please. All I just heard like, from that. Doesn't sound like a comic fan to me. Just because you read all these comics doesn't mean that you're some kind of comic head.
And I was like, oh, Bitch Planet. And I was like, I have a whole shelf of comics. I don't know why I said that to begin with, but.
We should have you back on to talk about Bitch Planet. That would be really
fuck
fun.
Yeah.
We talked about it, but we just did it as like a short review. So.
Oh, I would love to, because I just started reading it because someone recommended it to me.
Mm. Oh, fun, yeah. fun. Okay, we'll have to do that.
But I was very excited about both these movies. And then I also like, especially when you were talking about like complicated queer villains, I was like, and in sort of researching and thinking about these two movies, I did start seeing a lot of parallels, or started making parallels in my brain about it. And I was like, actually, this is perfect, because the way that there are two very complicated villains with two different endings, and sort of the feelings of both of like, it's hard when a villain that you like dies. Mm-hmm. And we can kind of get to the endings of both of them later. But do you guys want to start with I Care a Lot? Because I think that was the one I saw most recently.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. How would you describe I Care a Lot, Essie?
I'm like, what's the quick and dirty?
Yeah, I'm like, well, Marla Grayson.
Because it's like almost two different films. Like, you kind of get almost, well, it's actually, you know, the first act is what you see when you see the trailer for it. So you've got this badass, gorgeous, blonde, high femme who is taking care of, quote unquote, folks who are elderly and no longer capable of taking care of themselves. But it is sinister in that it's all a fucking grift. Everyone, at least that we see on screen, that is one of her wards, she's like a guardianship person, is, you know, someone who's been manipulated, and she's worked with a doctor to make them seem ill. And then she's, you know, the state has been like, okay, here, now you have control of all their finances. And it actually opens with a court case where a man who will be important later is yelling at her in the courtroom about, like, you won't let me see my mom. And she's like, you attacked a bunch of the guards. And it's so fascinating because it's almost... The film's really cleverly put together, right? Because you're seeing things from two directions at once, and you're seeing the way a really good puppeteer can manipulate people. And that is essentially what the main character is. And I cannot remember her name for the life of me.
Marla Grayson. And Rosamund Pike is the person who plays her. I can remember, yes, because I am in love with her. And I'm sad to say it, because she's truly awful. That's something that I liked about the movie, though, right? Is that, mm-hmm, she's a terrible person. And the movie has these moments of kind of pushing the audience towards sympathizing with her. But like the whole time they tell us who she is, like in the beginning and like through the movie, I feel like there's moments where I'm just like, maybe she's going to turn this all around. Like, maybe she's so beautiful. How can she be evil?
She's so amazing. Yeah. I love her so much, but also I know that she's terrible.
She's terrible. Yeah.
And it's like, I watched the trailer and immediately I was like, that's a movie I'm going to watch. Absolutely. So from watching the trailer, like, you already get the sense that she's a bad person. But even in the first, like, you know, 10 minutes, the opening scene in that court case, and the man confronts her outside, and the way that she handles him is the way that I wish I could be all the time. You know, just like,
yeah,
she's like such a like calm, collected bitch. And she is just like, when she sort of denigrates him about sort of like, you know, you're just mad because I'm not a man. And these sort of aggressive things that she's saying in a really pointed way shows, like, one, it's like so badass, you know? But what sucks is, like, in that first scene watching it, I already knew she was an evil person. I was like, mm-hmm. oh, don't make me like this evil person. But I think I really like her.
Yeah.
She's so beautiful and so amazing.
Well, and I think that's a very clever way of critiquing the form of feminism, the sort of like girl boss feminism that Marla ascribes to, right? And like, she, you know, when we hear her voice over in the beginning, she's like, there are no good people. I've been poor. Being poor sucks. So I'm going to be rich. And you just hear in the background, money. It's not actually there, but you can like feel yourself, money. You know, and like, it's such a high gloss film. And she's like, you said, she's like such a badass. She dresses awesome. She got a haircut. You're like, she has a cool office. She got a hot girlfriend. You know, she is like living that life. And she's a fucking monster. Yes. And that is like, it should cause cognitive dissonance for us, right? Like, we should be a smart enough audience that we're like, this is terrible. Why do I love her? I want her to win, but yes. she's terrible. And yes. then like her antagonist, one of her primary antagonists, played brilliantly by Peter Dinklage. Love so Peter good. Dinklage. He just nailed that role. He, you know, is a sort of mobster of some kind, and it's not totally clear. Yeah, she does name him at the end, but by then I was too high to remember names. I was like, I need to smoke some weed to be on the level with this movie. And so then, you know, you're like, oh, I want him to get his mom out of this like swindler's hands. And then it's like, oh, wait, he's a fucking terrible person who's actively trafficking women, you know, and you're just like, what the fuck, this movie?
Yeah,
and everyone is a evil. Terrible person too. Yeah, that's the thing. There's nobody good here, because it's like, even I believe the character name is Jennifer, even the person who is just like the elderly person who is being taken advantage of is a bad person. The guy in the beginning, even if something bad happened to him, and even if he's trying to see his mom, he's still a raging misogynist, right? Like, there's even Fran, who, like, I love, is just going to keep supporting Marla, you know? So I think that was part of it, right, is that every person is a bad person in this movie.
Yeah, no one was redeemable. No one even had a moment of, like, oh, maybe this is a bad thing that I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And they also very specifically made Marla evil in a way that is, like, not even, like, questionably evil, not, like, a both sides kind of thing. Preying on the elderly
right.
is awful. Like, that's not like a thing that you can massage to be like, well, I don't know. You know, that's like, oh no, she's like evil, evil. And that is, yeah, they put that on every single character. And it puts you at a sort of crossroads where you're like, you want to root for somebody, you think, like, but who are we rooting for? You know? But I guess I did sort of find myself rooting for Marla, but also acknowledging that she could not make it to the end of this movie, you know? Did you guys think that? Like, as the movie was going, did you think she was going to survive?
For me, I thought that it was basically just, it's totally, you know, classic movie, like the woman who is unrepentant and bad has to die at the end. It's the same as all of those old Bette Davis movies, right? Whenever yes. she was like the gangster mall and like all of that stuff. Early career Bette Davis, and how she was always kind of like a femme fatale, but like kind of a, like the proto-feminist as well. And a lot of those characters being queer-coded as well, I think was something that was interesting about this one, where she's just out and, you know, she's evil, but it's like not because she's gay, which is very different than like the message that you get a lot of the time whenever you're talking about the old, you know, femme fatale in like a noir movie, where you're just like, this lady hates men, which makes you think that maybe she's gay, right? But right, in the old right, movie, right. she never was. In this movie, she is. And it kind of made it better for me. But also, yeah, they totally turn it into a morality tale by the end of it.
Right.
And that to me is a thing where it's like, yeah, I knew that they couldn't, but I wish that they would just let her live in some ways. I kind of get annoyed by like there always being like morality tied to everything, where they're like, no, you have to learn a lesson from this movie, because you know what? In real life, Marla is still at the top of her career. We have Marlas in the world. They are still succeeding and they will live really long lives.
Yeah. I read a review about this that pointed out, or sort of discussed, how Why is it, you know, and I think this is a question all the time. It's like, why does the queer character always have to die? We have evil straight white men, Dexter, the Joker, who live at the end of their series or live at the end of the movie, mm-hmm. just sort of like quietly go away. And I struggled with that in a sense where I was like, well, I mean, I did kind of want her to die.
Yes. Yeah.
Like, I did want her to die.
Yeah, for sure.
But it always sort of, I don't know, I think it always hits me a little bit when say a queer character or a character of color is evil. I'm always like, I like that. I like that turn. I like that bit. But it also always makes me feel like, oh, why do they have to be evil? Or when these characters die, that always hits me just in a little bit of a way, even if I want them to die, I always feel some sort of empathy of like, oh, but why that character specifically?
Yeah, I think Sarah said this a couple times and I completely agree with her. I just think people overestimate, like creators, the power of killing off a character. Like, mm-hmm. I think they think that, like many of us, and I'm a creator, think that that's going to give sort of like an emotional payoff or an emotional connection with the film or you know, comic, what have you, that will make them feel really strongly about it. But I'm kind of like, you know, it's happened. Like, Game of Thrones happened. Like, I feel like it was a big moment of, like, upping the ante of, like, any motherfucker can die. Like, anybody. Anybody could just die. And so it's like, okay, yeah, that's called life. Like, I don't get it. Like, so that's kind of where I land with it. Like, I don't actually feel very – I saw someone who was like, it's bury your gaze. And I was like,
She's evil, though.
Like, and that's the thing is, like, I'm like, I don't think that being gay makes you not evil.
Yeah.
I don't think you get to play that card. And I think she would. I think Marla's that bitch, right? Like, Marla would play the feminism card, the being queer card time and time again. And I think she does it in an interesting way. It's not the way that everyone would play it. You know, she does it as sort of like a, I'm a hard bitch and you can't break me because I've been this my whole life. And that's kind of interesting. But yeah, I just kind of felt like, there's a million different outcomes. Here's when I knew they were going to kill her. When she made it through, well, I knew before I watched the movie because I read that article. I was like, I like spoilers. I'm like a monster that way. I'm like, I love to know what's going to happen in something because then I'm like, ooh, it's like peeking behind the curtain. Like, when did they decide? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I thought that maybe she might die when Peter Dinklage's character kidnaps her and then has his men kill her. And then she doesn't die. And I was like, damn, I kind of love that. Like, I kind of love that this.
She's so good, right? When she comes back,
right?
You're just like, oh my God.
Such a good adversary. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Her and like that he like likes her, you know, is what he ends up coming to. Like, he doesn't like her, but he's like, I respect you, you know, at the end, which was like pretty cool.
Yeah,
but that was kind of when I was like, once he made that offer to her, I was like, oh yeah, okay, I get it. Like, can't let, like, he's fine. Like, we don't see him die, right? Like, he's allowed to keep the big business and have he's trafficking women and that's fine. And he's allowed to, you know, so on and such forth. But a woman, a gay woman, like, she must die. Like, come on, guys. So, I don't know. I feel like both ways about it.
I also feel, I think, both ways about it. Because now that you're saying that, I did think about I think who else died in the movie? Just the doctor, Dr. Karen, and then
Dr. Karen.
Yeah, who was also just immediate, like inherently evil, right? Just like, oh, you're a bad doctor.
Even if you're played by Alicia Witt, you're terrible.
Yeah.
I'm like, don't try and pull a quick one on me, you hottie. Yeah. I'm not paying attention to that.
Yeah, that's the same with every character in this movie, though, where you're like, stop trying to trick me with your beauty.
I think, like, a couple henchmen die. Like, I think,
oh yeah,
you know, the guy who's driving the taxi, I think he dies.
Oh, right.
And then I think the two guys who try to kill her.
Minor characters?
Like, one of them. Yeah, like, but, like, minor characters. They're not, I don't think any of them have names. Like,
he's definitely the only main character that dies.
Yeah.
So. But it was like, Peter Dinklage got to live because, because he's quiet. I just thought of that. It's like, I mean, part of Marla's thing is that she's also very boisterous. She's very, like, upfront, very boisterous. She likes the attention. She likes, you know, she's going on these these like interviews and these television shows. You know, she's really, really out there. And I think that was, and I don't know, and that's not part of why she had to die, but certainly contributed to her death, being very like in the public eye and being very aggressive about being in the public eye in that way, or the appearance of being in the public eye, you know?
Definitely. Definitely. I felt for, I felt for her girlfriend. I was like really sad for her girlfriend.
I love her. Friend.
Who's, again, not like a good character, right? She's enabling all of this. She's actually literally helping her, you know? But I didn't want her to hold her dying partner. That made me sad.
I was glad that Fran lived. Yeah. Fran's going to have a long and happy life, hopefully. But Marla can't have one. And I don't know. I definitely heard people, because people always, every time there's like a gay villain, I feel like somebody comes at me with evil lesbian trope or something. And I'm just like, well, speaking as an evil lesbian, like, I don't know. You know, I just don't think, I feel like now there's like a, there's more good gay people in things than there were in like the 60s, like whenever it was like all villains. I think it's okay for there still to be villains,
right? That's I still want that sort of like diversity in a character, do you know what I mean? Like I don't, you know, I don't need everyone to be evil, I don't need everyone to be good, I want to see a
the
range.
Pressure right
yeah
the pressure
yeah, yeah.
of being like, oh, all the lesbians have to be good now.
Right, like, yeah, totally, yeah.
Well, I mean, I've met some evil lesbians before.
You know who I think did the best evil queer women was actually the TV show Killjoys, which is from Canada. They had a couple of murder girlfriends who were just like, so they did not fucking care, man. Manipulating this motherfucker, making this person get this person pregnant. It was actually amazing.
And what am I doing? Writing it down right now.
Exactly.
Because we love evil lesbians. That's the thing. Like,
it's so fun. It's so fun. And I think you're right. Like, so I was trying to think of an example, because my favorite thing is when the villain and the hero, for lack of a better term, have a identities in common. So I like when it's like Bitch Planet is a great example, right? Like, women are oppressing women. That's like part of what's happening there. Yes, it's under the guise of, you know, toxic masculinity, patriarchy, etc. But like, women are part of the process of, you know, disciplining, imprisoning other women. And I think that is always very interesting, because then you start to get into like these inter-community conversations. But yeah, I think when it's like the bad person, and I'm using scare quotes, I always do that when I'm on the pod. I'm like, I'm using scare quotes, and you can't see my hands. You know, I think that the bad person, so to speak, is if they're the only queer character, I'm bummed. If they're the only, you know, character of color, I'm bummed. The reason this worked for me, the reason I Care a Lot worked for me, was holy shit, the production is through the roof. It is just a very beautifully made film. Mm-hmm. They choose their colors in every room really well. So I felt like as like a cinephile, I was just like eating candy of like the best kind watching it. I was just like, yes. And then, you know, no one's good. Like you were saying, Sarah, even Jennifer in this situation is absolutely a bad person. And so mm-hmm. I'm a little bit more willing to be like, all right, fine. Like, the queer person's terrible. All right, fine. You're going to kill her. Like, I wouldn't make those choices necessarily, but, you know.
Yeah.
Like Sarah said, I don't need a moral at the end of everything that I'm like, I'm good. Like,
right.
I'm not going to go be Marla. But I'm also like, maybe they legally had to have her die because they didn't want people out there like trying this grift on people.
Right. Right. I did like that, you know, cinematically, definitely agreeing with what you're saying. Beautiful colors. Like, I watched it twice, and the second time I really just sort of took in all the visuals. But there's a lot of like zoom kind of close-up shots of people's faces, and just looking at everyone's eye color, I noticed it was like really strong eye contact, which I think is also part of just Marla's whole kind of personality, is like strong eye contact, because mm-hmm. she's like not letting you fucking get away with anything. But I also noticed the sort of the very movie stuff in it that sort of lets you understand that this is in a different world, such as the briefcase full of cash, which is like such a fake movie thing, you know, or like the fact that like one of the things is like the bag full of diamonds, which is such another, which just seems like such a fictional mafia thing, you know,
right.
Like, ooh, I have a bag full of diamonds. It's like, who?
You're like, oh, it's Ocean's 11.
Yeah.
This is so fun.
I mean? Yeah. And so, and I like that. I like those elements that sort of, that remind me that I'm watching a movie. And even like the grift is like a little bit impossible. Like, it's not, it is right. definitely,
it's
like,
too clean. Everything too works clean. Too easily, right? I don't like that, like, you know what you just made me realize? It's like, I really hate that the judge is a black man that they're duping. Oh, I'm yeah. like, that's not a good call. Why is your only black person, like, helping facilitate this? I don't like that.
But you make a good point that actually I think Judge Lomax is the only nice person. But unintentionally, yeah. he just doesn't know stuff.
Yeah.
Well, and then it gives you the person who's doing things with the best of intentions who is still ruining lives every single day, right?
So
right.
like
there is something about that. I wouldn't disagree, though, honestly. And so, I don't know. To me, that was kind of how I was reading it. I did think that that was a fairly interesting character. But yeah, it is kind of, this person is just so charming that no matter how smart you are, you will never... never like get one over right, on Marla like, Grayson.
Yeah.
I fucking meet Marla in the street and I know exactly who she is. I meet that bitch in the wild and I'm like, you're my enemy. I know exactly who you are. You know, like I'm like,
I would just follow
you
her.
You would like fall in love with her.
I would be like, where, who are we going to kill? Do you want me to kill somebody?
She's your Pied Piper.
I'll literally turn into Garth from Wayne's World whenever it's like Kim Basinger. He's a dead man with like the gun. That's me. Sadly.
Isn't that Fran though? Because I think Fran is in love with Marla because of her power, because yeah. of sort of, because of the way she presents herself and like how much of a badass she is. You know what I mean? I think Fran thrives on that just as much and is there to enable this stuff.
Right.
There's a small part sort of, I think early on, especially after Dr. Karen dies, when Fran is like, hey, maybe we should stop this. You know, just like,
yeah,
take the money and let's go. And Marla is the one that pushes it.
Won't do
to
it.
That
yeah.
point. Right. Yeah. And then, you know, and then Fran later relents not that hard. She's just like, oh, okay. Yeah. Let's fucking do this. And you can kind of see that relationship between the two of them, you know?
Oh, yeah. I was going to say, too, that you can see Fran, because when Marla shows up and, like, literally saves her life, who among us wouldn't be, like, completely in love with this person who, like, did everything for you? But then it's like the one thing she didn't do for you was make this not happen, right? She still used Fran as collateral damage.
Yeah.
That's wild. But I know how Fran is looking at it because we've all dated people who were terrible. And then it's just like, you see only the parts that you want to see. And I was just like, wow, this is one of the most, you know, upsettingly relatable characters, but also is just an amazing character. I thought that she was one of the best parts in the movie.
Yeah, she was great.
And part of their relationship, as we get to see, is they clearly have a bangarang sex life.
Oh my God.
Oh God, yeah.
And who among us hasn't been with someone because they fucked you so good and you're like, God damn it, I don't even like you that much, but fuck, this sex is so good.
I cannot, that's all of my relationships. And I cannot even, like.
I just want to give you a hug.
I cannot even tell
that's
you. Like, that scene with them on the stairs is seared into my mind. I will never be able to forget it. It will haunt my dreams forever. Because they're so beautiful. They're
it's
just
so beautiful.
Both the most beautiful couple I've ever seen.
Yeah,
right?
Very, very glossy, beautiful couple, which also, like, and I know this is just, like, a Hollywood thing, but sometimes when they're impossibly, an impossibly beautiful couple, I'm like, that's not, I can't have that. I don't need that anymore. Like, I can't.
Get them out of here.
Yeah, get out of here. That's too much. That is too much.
But you're overselling it.
Yeah, I mean, they're both so stunningly gorgeous. Like, absolutely.
So stunning. Just,
and I think gloss
me?
Is the word. I think you got
very
the word
glossy.
Right with gloss. Like, the whole yeah. film is gloss. And her whole personality is gloss, right? Like, she's Marla, she's constantly, you know, putting on a show for people and then doing something mm-hmm. else they're not looking at, you know, very sleight of hand, very, very magician.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I love movies made like this. They're just so clever. And I don't know if Americans are like
smart enough for this movie, which, like, I don't mean as like to insult our intelligence, but like sometimes we're like, oh, I'll just eat the corn syrup, and it's like, don't eat the corn syrup. And like, or if you do eat the corn syrup, like, don't like think it's good for you. Like, it's okay to eat the corn syrup, but you need to know it's corn syrup, right? Like, I don't know, I'm getting in a food thing, but
eat other things sometimes too.
Yes,
not just corn syrup, maybe.
Exactly. I just feel like it's so cleverly done that it makes you root for bad people. And if you don't examine rooting for bad people, it's easy to get into a morally gray place. And I feel like I know just too many people who are about like making money.
Yeah.
That would, you know, see something like this and I hope still be disturbed, because I think they do make everything disturbing enough, right? Like,
right.
If her victims had been someone we were less sympathetic to, it would be harder. But like it being the elderly, that makes it like pretty clear. Like, you're like, this person's like a trash can fire. Like, mm-hmm. this is not good. But yeah, I don't know. I was watching it going like, I can't believe I'm rooting for her. Like, I want her to get out of this car that's in this lake so bad. Like, I want her to get out and go kill those guys. And what is that? Why am I rooting for her?
Right. Yeah.
Because they keep setting her up, and I think they do this many times throughout the film. They set her up on these one-on-one where it's like her and some sort of like evil kind of counterpart, and she wins almost every time, right? The very first scene when she's talking to the courtroom guy, later when she's talking to Dean, the lawyer, the sort of the other sort of evil lawyer, you know, when they're in the office. And he's trying to convince her to, like, take the money or try to, you know, to let Jennifer Peterson go. And so there's that. And then there's the scene where she's
talking with Chris Messina. What a fucking actor.
He's so good in it. I
have such a thing for him. I can't even help myself. I'm just like, that man.
Fantastic in it.
Call me.
Are you listening? Give me a call.
Call Chris.
Chris.
He's like, excuse me?
The costuming also was fantastic for every character. For him, yeah. Playing the sort of like, you just his suit, the watch that he was wearing, a little bit like little sleazy lawyer guy. Mm-hmm. God, so cool. So cool. But what they do with Marla is they keep setting her up in these like one-on-one sort of matches. She keeps winning until, and even, I guess even when, you know, when they try to drown her in the car, she keeps winning. And I think that's why we keep rooting for her, right? Because I think we always like to think that if we're in these sorts of situations, we always want to, like, you know, we want to be able to be that smart and that quick and that, like, on top of it.
Yeah.
And then I also, did you guys notice in the facility, there's the scene, and it's in the background, but the older folks, like the sort of extras in the scene, they're playing Mortal Kombat on the big screen. Did you guys notice that?
Yes.
I didn't know, but I forgot. That makes me so happy.
I thought that was so great, because I was like, oh, that was such a fun little nod to everything that's going on. Again, this sort of one-on-one sort of Marla versus each sort of like each evil person. And I was like,
she's going through the gauntlet, like the tournament. I love it.
She is going through the tournament. And I like, that was such a, like, I didn't notice that until the second watch. And I was like, oh, that is very, very fun. Very, very fun and very, very smart.
I do think there's a lot of things like that in the movie. Another one that I caught that I thought was like, you know, it works because they delivered it just well enough. But when she calls the guy who runs the nursing home or the residential facility, and he's like, oh, hey, Marla, have you ever heard of the Milgram experiment? And she's like, I don't have fucking time to talk to you. And those moments remind me of like when I was studying film, and you're kind of like trying to find, especially when you're like in college, and you're like, I don't know what I'm talking about. Like, look how smart I can be. Did that work? It reminded me of that kind of moment where it's like, wow, like that's partially, it can be kind of clunky dialogue, but I kind of liked it. I thought it worked. And bringing in that element, if for those of us who maybe are less familiar with the Milgram experiment, which I believe is based at Yale, and it is the study where a participant is told to shock someone if they don't do the, like, they're watching someone through a window, the participant, and they're shocking someone if they don't do what they're told to do right. The person who they're shocking is actually an actor. They're not connected to anything that's shocking them. And then the observer is watching the person who's doing the shocking, not the person being shocked. And people were willing to just
give people lethal doses of electricity because that's what they were told to do. It started like right after the Eichmann in Jerusalem trial. And it was partially, that's part of why the creator, which is Stanley Milgram, came up with the ideas. He's like, why are people evil? And I think that this, it's such a fascinating thing to bring into the film because I don't think there's any one-to-one. The way that like with Mortal Kombat, there's like a very clear one-to-one, but it does yeah. talk about like, which I love. I'm like obsessed with that. I'm like, I can't wait to go watch it again. but it does sort of highlight the way that we are so cold to other people's pain if mm-hmm. we think we're doing the right thing in literally any definition of the term, right? Marla thinks she's doing the right thing because she's out for her. And she thinks that's the way to survive. And it's like, that does not make that the right thing, my friend. So I think the film's full of like layers of just like philosophy and you know, just trying to push against like, what is human nature and what does it mean if we're all bad, right? Like that's Marla's argument. She does a voiceover at the beginning, at the end, where she's like, everyone's bad. Don't tell me no one's bad. She is an unreliable narrator. Let me start by saying that. But you really do start to understand her. And I think that that is creepy, right? Because it's kind of an insight into all of us. Like we're kind of bastards as humans, you know? It's like, oh no.
That's true. I would also like to note, though, that the Milgram experiment has been deeply questioned by yes. new research. And so
it was all men in it. There's a bunch of flaws in the Milgram experiment.
There's a lot of flaws in it. And then you get kind of the same effect of something like the bystander effect, where it's like, well, that was bullshit. Like the story that it's based on of Kitty Genovese is not necessarily what happened, right?
Right.
So I would say that it does make perfect sense that that specific character said those words to Marla Grayson.
Exactly.
I would also just like to make a note of the fact that Marla's cynical worldview falls apart with almost any pressure whatsoever.
Exactly. So, exactly. Yes. And that was like the thing I was dancing around, Sarah. So I think you're totally correct. The other thing that was like a super tiny moment that I wanted to see what you both thought, and maybe I'm, you know, reaching, but there's this moment where Peter Dinklage is torturing her and he's like, I know where your mother is and I'm going to kill her.
Right.
And she's like, please be my guest. I hate that fucking sociopath.
The fact that she called her mom, that was interesting because it was definitely just like, damn, like, A, I don't even know if it's like bravado, you know, like it's hard to tell mm-hmm. because yeah. obviously mm-hmm. she doesn't want to give this guy an inch anyway.
Right.
So maybe she does care, but also we do assume that she's alienated from her mother, right?
Yes.
And her having a tumultuous, shitty relationship with her mom might explain a lot of things. but also I loved that they didn't give her that room because she yep. doesn't deserve it. We don't need exactly. to know. Like she's a bad person. If they had pushed it to that place, I would have been like, this is a little much, you guys. Like,
yeah, exactly.
Totally. I did notice, like, we don't have a lot of exposition or backstory on Marla, like, at least, like, sort of how she grew up. She, you know, she mentions that she was poor, used to be poor, so you can sort of, you know, take what you want from that, from her background growing up, and you know that she doesn't like her mother. I don't know, I never got the sense that she was maybe covering, you know, about the sort of mother thing, right? When she said it, I believe the things that she says. And when she says, like, that she doesn't give a shit about that fucking sociopath, I was like, oh, okay, cool. Well, that's something to unpack later.
Right.
And those are the only things that we really know about her, right? She sort of had maybe some sort of, not necessarily like a rough childhood, but an alienating, or maybe a childhood that where she felt a little othered or a little alienated.
I'm sure we'll get a Disney film going into her backstory. So we can all be looking forward to that.
Right, yeah. But I also love the idea that I love in the movie this sort of varying degrees of motherhood. You know, like there's sort of like Marla's mother, she doesn't like, apparently a sociopath. Whereas Peter Dinklage's character has obviously a very strong bond with his mother. And like, and his mother also like, you know, comes off a little innocent in the beginning, but then she has that moment where she like almost strangles, or she like strangles Marla. And I like that sort of that twist there. It also plays into the idea that it's like, oh, everyone's evil, even the elderly.
Yeah.
Like, because there's a sense that it's sort of like, oh, being a mobster's mother, you're also probably a badass. It seems to be in the lineage, like a part of their family. And I thought that was an interesting thing because I feel like I like the diversity of mothers, I guess, because it always seems like mothers are held up in so many films as sort of like the reason why people are evil is because of their mothers, or the reason why people are good is because of their mothers. And I like that people having different relationships with their mothers in this film, they still ended up really evil either way.
Mm-hmm. I like that too. Hey everybody, I hope you're enjoying the show. We're enjoying the time that we spend with you. We have made a Patreon. There is more episodes on it. You can listen to all of the episodes on it if you subscribe at any level. You could do $2, you could do $10, you could do $20. We've had a few who did $20, listener. And while we don't expect that from everybody, if you wanted to give us $20 a month, that'd be chill. And you could also give us two, or you could literally give us none. Go ahead and check out the Patreon anyway, because there's a ton of free episodes. We love it when you support the show because it means that we can keep making the show. And that's always really nice. But also, just check it out. Go listen to our free cage match or the Ghost Rider Corner or some of SE's comic reviews of webcomics, many things. Also, I mean, didn't we just do a whole episode about Amalgam Comics? We've done a ton of things. You can listen to so much of it for free. So go check out the Patreon if you've run out of episodes in your regular feed, which some people have, I've heard. Go to patreon.com/bitchesoncomics. You got to spell the whole thing out. You can't search us. We're 18 plus because we say fuck a lot.
Speaking of films with interesting portrayals of parenting, should we talk about Let the Right One In?
Yes.
Oh my God.
So you had not seen this before?
I had not seen this before.
Oh God, I love this movie so much.
I love this movie. So Let the Right One In is a Swedish film, like we said at the beginning, from 2008. It is described as a romantic horror film. Again, I want to get into that. I don't know that I agree or disagree, but I just want to talk about it. And it's basically a film about a 12-year-old boy who is being just bullied, frankly tortured by his classmates, and he's like a very, you know, very pale, very small, not particularly masculine young boy. And then a new girl moves into his housing area and they become friends. They meet at night and he doesn't think anything of that until he does because she's a vampire, which is great. I loved it. So when did you first see this? Did you see it when it came out?
I did see it around the time it came out. I believe I was working at a movie theater at the time when it came out. And also, I just love vampire movies. Like, if there's some cool vampire movie or even a bad vampire movie, I will go and see it. So I did see it when it came out. Definitely was immediately blown away because I think in this time period when it came out, what, 2008, was definitely like Twilight era vampire movies, you know, or like teen vampires that were in school for some reason. So when this came out, I remember being like, oh great, like we're back to like cool, dark, sort of weird, uncomfortable vampire movies. And then I really followed it. I never read the book, but I have read a lot about the book. And then I remember the remake a few years later. But yeah, I've definitely been a big, big fan of this one since it came out. There's something about it being Swedish, which makes it not like creepier, but the way you picture Sweden, you know, sort of like beautiful, idyllic, everything sort of really functional
and like, yes,
nicely shaped. And then it's like, but it's also like very cold and wintry. I love that contrast of the setting of all of this snow, and also the idea of Ellie not feeling the cold is such a fucking cool little detail. Or the way she says it, she says something that's like, I guess I forgot or something. She's like, she's so old. She's like, she forgot how to feel. And I was like, oh, I know what that feels. That's me. I've gotten so old, I don't know how to feel.
Sarah Sarah, when did you first see this film?
Oh, I must have been. I mean, honestly, like I used to have IFC and like I would just, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning be watching some pretty random things. And I think that this was one of the random things that I saw. And I remember even in the moment being like, I'm pretty sure this is like a very queer and like very weird and very cool movie. But then I didn't really hear much about it. Like not a lot of people that I knew had seen it. So years later, of course, I discover that, you know, it's this whole thing and everybody loves this movie. So I was excited to see it. I'm always excited to talk about this movie because it's great.
It's so good. It's so, so good. Yeah, I love vampire shit, too. So I'm like, I enjoy a good vampire. I'm always looking for, like, who's got a good twist on a vampire, right? Like, because, you know, we've been doing them for, I don't even know, like, ever. We've been talking about vampires. We're like, oh, there's probably something out there that'll suck your blood around this fire. Stay close to it.
Yeah,
This is one of those that it doesn't do, like, a ton different with the idea of vampires, right? Like, she needs blood to survive. She's alive, though. She's not dead, which I like that, like, detail. She's unaging, which is, you know, pretty typical. She doesn't glimmer in the sun, so I'm sorry for everyone who was hoping for that. But I think it still manages to be this, like, very quiet, yet very violent, yet very beautiful and romantic film. And I'm like, well, damn if I don't love it.
Mm-hmm. I was really happy for you whenever I found out that this was like the first time you had seen it, because it's just immediately like, of course, Essie will love this movie. Like, this is like the Essie movie almost. Uh-huh. As far as like a horror film goes, I feel like it pulls out all the stops. But yeah, it's definitely a very haunting movie, too. I think that there's a lot about the relationship between the two, right? Where it's just, I think almost all of us, and that's part of what is so maybe queer about it, but like also just like the outsider feeling of it, is that you have a person who you kind of cling to, right? Whenever I know whenever I was young, like you always have like a friend who you're just like, you are the friend,
right?
Like, you're the one. And then you're just like, I don't even know if I would call that like romantic, right? You were saying that romantic is a weird connotation for the movie. And it's like, well, yeah, because like, it is kind of weird to look at it like that. But like, I would say that it's a very just true, right? It just feels true because it's like everybody has had a friend like that, I feel like, whenever they're young.
Yeah. And I mean, I use the term romance pretty loosely on this in the sense that it's like, it's mm-hmm. definitely, you know, sort of like an asexual relationship between the two of them, you know, and it's like the fact that they're both 12 years old and sort of in that prepubescent kind of stage. But mm-hmm. I also like, I absolutely like was in love with all of my friends, you know, like the sort of, and when you find that other person, whether, you know, whether it's, you know, like a sexual relationship or when you're just 12 years old and you are in love with your friends, it mm-hmm. is like so sweet. And I think that that for me was like, oh, such a kicker. These two finding each other in this way of both being bullies and victims, you know, I think they're both of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And when Oscar asked her in an early scene,
will you go steady with me?
You go steady.
Yeah, it's so cute.
I'm crying.
And then she's like, well, what would that mean? And he says, you'd be my girlfriend. And she says, I'm not a girl.
Yes.
And I don't know if you all remember this, but there's actually a shot later where we see her lower half naked.
Yes.
And she's clearly a trans girl.
Yes.
And I think of Oscar very much as like a gender nonconforming child. Like,
oh, yeah.
I don't know what his, you know, we don't get to see what his gender journey is or might be. But it seems to me that it's unlikely that he's going to come to a very cis normative conclusion.
Right.
And so I kind of read it as a T for T love story. And that mm-hmm. that for me was, I didn't know I was reading it as that. So when you were like, oh, there's a lot of gender stuff, you know, you never know what someone's going to say, like what that means. Like,
right.
There's plenty of stuff I watched that like someone else would watch and be like, that's very cishet. And I'd be like, no, that's the queer shit I've ever seen. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
So I wasn't sure if this would be coding or explicit. And what I love about it is that it's both. And I think that's one of the reasons it's such a successful film. And there's so much tenderness and ferocity in each of the characters. And that, I think, is so human, you know, despite one of them being a vampire. And I think that's such a, I don't know, it's really beautiful. Yeah, I think a lot of queer people have been extremely bullied. You know, Oscar's situation is like, even for extreme bullying, extreme, you know, at mm-hmm. the end of the, toward the end of the film, he's almost killed by an older boy. And I love someone who is like super evil, but also like loves someone. I got Jennifer's Body's feels off of Let the Right One In a little bit, you know, where I was like, I kind of feel like Jennifer is just like an older version of, and I've totally forgotten her name.
Ellie,
thank you. In a way, you know, where it's like, these are just like women who are very comfortable, and a woman and a girl who are very comfortable with like this transformation that's happened to them and the sort of like advantages and limitations thereof, even if they're not wholly happy with it. Like, I wouldn't say Ellie is like, yay, I'm a vampire. You know, she's kind of like, I'm stuck at 12 forever.
Yeah. Right. No, that's a big struggle for her. And I will say, before, like, when the first time I watched it, I think early on, and I probably just love this in general, but sort of androgynous young characters I'm always in love with, you know, and I love that the both of them are a little bit, you know, they're before it's even discussed, just like as they are presented on the screen, it is there. You know, the subtext is pretty just as a lot of text. It's just there. Do you know what I mean?
It's like subtext only is text. Like kind of subtext.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. And it's like, especially because Ellie says it twice, right? Ellie says it twice that like Ellie is not a girl. And the way that she says it so subtly, but also the way that like Oscar is very, he's like, okay, but can we still go steady or what?
Just like, oh, that moment. I was just like, fine, Oscar, I love you.
Oh, I know.
Yeah, Oscar.
Yeah.
Like, so cute.
And it's like so pure. And I love that about the two of them. And the interesting thing about Ellie also is like, Ellie also inherently evil, you know?
Yeah.
As an immortal, blood-sucking creature, she is technically pretty evil. But...
And we watch her kill people, and we watch her dad kill people to like get food for her, you know,
right.
You know, dad figure.
Yes.
So yeah, there's like a lot of what we would traditionally be like, this is evil.
Yeah. But I was so enamored also, you know, just with her, or just so like on her side, because it did, you know, absolutely on her side in a way that like with Marla, I wanted to be on Marla's side, but she really made it difficult for me. Whereas like Ellie, I was like, I'm on your side, and like everything that's happening, I'm still on your side. Even the people you kill, unfortunately, they don't seem that interesting. So I just like, there's something like,
that's cool.
About even, you know what I mean? And the way that it's portrayed, it is a way, and it is sort of, it does feel a little messed up to say out loud, to be like, well, but she was like pretty cool. But she
I
was.
I read her as such a hero. She's such a hero in this film. Like, as much as she has those, what we would call villainous qualities, as much as she is like, absolutely killing people. You know, she's tiny. When she jumps on that woman's back and like starts, you know, consuming her blood, a male adult comes up and throws Ellie aside like it's nothing. She doesn't have super strength. You know,
right.
She's not a true blood vampire. She's not a, there's so many limitations she has. And I think that is such a clever choice by the creators to give her some grotesque features, but not sort of like the superhuman that we often think of with vampires. Like, she's not seducing anyone. She's not, you know, trying to create an army of vampires. She's just trying to survive. And that
she's a survivor.
Heartbreaking.
Which is, I mean, and that's also a lot of her backstory, because, you know, she didn't choose to be a vampire. And she didn't choose to be castrated. This was, you know, Essie, do you know her sort of origin story, which is only slightly touched upon in the movie? Like, it's a little bit, you know, they sort of gloss over it a little bit in the movie, but the book describes how she became a vampire. And, you know, she's like hundreds of years old. She came from a poor peasant family, and she was, I think, like kidnapped by like a nobleman, a really sadistic nobleman, who castrated her and also made her a vampire because he was a pedophile. There's a lot of pedophilia in the book, and that's why she's trapped as a 12-year-old. And it's a really unfortunate story. It's tough. It's a very, the book is very, very dark. and very violent and very graphic. Also a really good book. But that whole part of her story, like in that one scene, you know, when she's undressing, they show it a little bit and she kind of talks about it. But I think probably for general movie audiences, I don't think they wanted to get too deep into that. You know, I think they really wanted to focus on just like the story of the two kids.
And it's one of those things where like that what we omit also is really important in storytelling. So there's a way where you as the viewer are left like wondering, like, how could this have happened? Like, what would, why would someone turn a child into a vampire? And if I didn't come to those conclusions, the specific ones, but it didn't seem like a good thing is what I'll say. Right. No part of me was like, some nice vampire turned her into a vampire for good reasons, you know?
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Doesn't seem likely.
Probably not.
Yeah, well, that's so heartbreaking.
It's really dark. But even without knowing that, you know, like a 12-year-old vampire, that's not like a chill thing, you know, like you don't have to know the whole story to know that like whatever her origin is, it comes from sort of a tragic, really sad, terrible beginning.
Mm-hmm. And part of it is just that part of her friendship with Oscar is not telling him about that, right? Mm-hmm. Which is like kind of a thing. I think sometimes with your friends, if you go through a bunch of shit, is to be like, we don't have to talk about it right now. Like, don't worry about it, Oscar.
Yeah. And Oscar's acceptance of her just all around, also of her just being a vampire.
He figures it out so well.
Like, I love that.
You know, that's so cute. And he doesn't come at her with a stake or a cross or like the things that we often see, even when there's a reconciliatory moment after. Like, Oscar's like, no, come into my house without permission. I want to see what happens. He's curious, you know? He's not like, I want to control you. I want to own you. I want to hurt you. He's like, I want to know more about this. This seems kind of incredible.
Of course. And that's like, of course, that's why they're in love. Because it's like, you love the people that like see you as you are and let you be that, you know? And who's also own, whose like weirdness matches your own weirdness. Cause Oscar, we can talk about Oscar. He has, you know, aside from being like, he's definitely, they portray him as a real serial killer in the making, you know, like he's like,
his first line in the film is like, squeal, squeal like a pig. And you're just like, what the fuck? Like I don't even see a kid yet.
Childhood of a Leader? Just let the right one in. It's fine.
Yeah. And he's stabbing that tree and you're like, oh, this kid is disturbed. But
he's also hurt, right? Yes. Which is like something that's very interesting, I think, about him. And then also the way that they do befriend one another is, it's like the thing that we talk about really regularly, actually, on this podcast among characters that have lived through significant trauma that end up finding each other. We talk about it with Poison Ivy and Harley Quinn a lot, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where it's just like two people going through trauma and then becoming friends. It's like it doesn't, you know, there's all kinds of people who make all kinds of friends, but there's always something a little bit special about being like, oh, I don't really have to lie or like, you know, spare you of like something terrible that's happened to me because I know it's happened to you too, right?
Totally. Like you hurt, like I hurt.
Yeah. Which like, yeah, I mean, here I think is portrayed very positively. And I think in a lot of our lives, it can be a really positive thing. So I like that about it too.
Yeah, it does seem like they find a lot of comfort and healing together. And I think, you know, in contrast to I Care a Lot, the ending of Let the Right One In is incredibly hopeful. You know, we see, spoiler alert, this movie from 2008, I mean. Like, it's cool. We don't have the spoiler alert.
2008.
The greatest year ever. I have no idea why I would say that. But it wasn't the greatest year ever. But, you know, he is being held underwater in a pool. I think maybe the reason part of the like connection with Jennifer's body is like that big scene in the pool was like, is imprinted on my mind. And so I'm like, is Jennifer's body like toasting this? Like, is that a reference? I don't know.
No, see, I like this more than I like the scene in Jennifer's body because this one ends with them realizing how much they rely on each other.
It's so
whereas
sweet.
In Jennifer's body.
Jennifer's body different just happened to be made in the U.S. So. So they had to have the succubus pay each other.
Yeah. Right.
I'm like,
right.
No, she wants to wife her. They want to wife each other. This is bullshit.
Let it happen. Be the demon
murder
wife.
Girlfriends. More murder girlfriends.
Murder girlfriend, demon wife. Yes. All right. Well, that's what this movie really gives us in a way.
Yes, it does.
Murder girl. You know, both movies were murder girlfriends for sure.
That's true. Yeah. Ugh.
That demon scene wife, where they're like, you know, it's after Aaliyah has protected Oscar and they're, you know, you kind of like don't know what's going to happen. Like he was in a pool with four boys and they're all dead now. Like, what's going to happen to Oscar?
That's a great. Just a great murder scene, by the way.
Oh, my God. Beautiful.
A little bit off screen, but you can tell it's happening. And then also the audio of being underwater, you know, like, and just Oscar's eyes being closed the whole time is, oh, so beautiful. Like, such,
so good.
Such a good-looking scene.
Yeah, and when they do show the bodies, it's so zoomed out. And then you've got the one, like,
the one kid
who's crying, which was the kid who didn't like being a bully but still was the bully, you know?
Yeah.
Like, he's there crying, and you're just like, what the fuck's going to happen? And then it cuts to that train scene, and, and you... Oh, my God. We didn't even talk about the Morse code.
Oh, like, my God.
They both learn Morse code so they can, like, communicate through the walls of their apartment. And then he's on the train, and he's got, like, a little box at his feet. You're like, no, where's Ailey? And then he, like, does his Morse code on the box, and she replies. Oh, I'm going to cry. I loved it so much.
No, I think that's also such another a fun little thing is that, you know, When you're with somebody in that way, you have your own language. And I think to show that as, like, in this particular instance, as, like, Morse code is, like, the way that they communicate, you know, the way they sort of, like, secretly communicate is just so fucking adorable. Like, so adorable. And, yeah, the positive, the sort of, like, uplifting ending that, like, Ellie got to live and she found sort of a new caretaker to sort of be her human friend in the world. And I will also note, you guys, that this is very positive because the original book ends there, but then there's a follow-up kind of short story that's about the two of them where Oscar is older and they're still together. So,
yeah, you know what that kind of made me wonder? Is in the book, do they get into her, like, parental figure at all? Like, do we know more about him in the book? Because in the film, he's just, like, Hawken? There.
Yeah. Oh. Yes, unfortunately, Hawken is a pedophile. Aw,
damn.
Son of a...
I'm interested. Did you glean any of that from the movie? Like,
no, I didn't. But now that you say it, I'm like, okay, I can... Because there is a weird vibe between them.
Right.
Where, like, he's keeping her alive, but she doesn't like him.
Right.
And... But then, like, you know, when the way that he, you know, sacrifices, you know, he burns his face off with acid. So when he gets caught by the cops, they can't identify him. That kind of felt like a weird reversal. And I'm, you know, and I know there's like layers to pedophilia that are like,
yeah,
I don't want to talk about. I don't fucking care.
It is a, yeah, he's a real, in the movie, he's a real like Renfield type character, right? Like a little bit of like a slave to the vampire. While also like taking care of it and having this sort of symbiotic relationship and what he's getting out of it. In the book, he is definitely a pedophile and he's sort of like, you know, looking for young boys. And but Ellie comes across him first and sort of they kind of, you know, have this again, a weird, very uncomfortable symbiotic relationship, you know, where like he's sort of able to get off sexually with her, you know, in the book in a way, sort of have this young, this forever young person in his life. But she also gets someone to murder and feed her all the time, you know, murder for
her.
Ooh,
that's gross.
It is incredible.
I feel great about him dying in the film.
Very,
now.
Very gross.
I feel very good about his death now. I'm like,
right.
No more sympathy there.
Interesting sacrificial death. Right.
Yeah. Beautifully shot again, like a very beautiful film.
Yeah. Oh, and of course, because pedophilia is very uncomfortable to talk about and to watch and to even try to work into a story. Every time I'm like, do we need that in the story? Is this like a thing? I think the decision to take that part sort of out of the movie was because it reading some interviews with the director and the screenwriter who also wrote the book was, you know, they didn't, it was too many heavy things going on. Like they didn't want to, you know, sort of, they wanted to have a much simpler, cleaner story, which is like, it's easy to expand that stuff in fiction, but in a movie, I understood. And I'm glad for it. I'm glad that that was, even though it was like kind of gleaned and a little weird. I don't know if I needed that. I don't need that, actually. Like, I don't need that in this movie.
It seems like story relevant. I mean, I never want to read anything with pedophilia in it or see anything. I'm just like, This is not something I need in my life. But there has to be a reason there's a 12-year-old vampire, right? Like, you can't just be like, there's a 12-year-old vampire for no reason. So it does seem story relevant in a way where I'm willing to tolerate it like a little bit more for that sake. But I do think the film didn't suffer in any way by not having that. Yes. I think the trauma is so, Oscar's trauma takes place on screen. And so it kind of stands in for Ailee's trauma. We don't have to see her go through that because we're watching someone else be traumatized.
Right.
And so then you get this person who is also traumatized come in and be able to, like Sarah was saying, heal through this new relationship with another person who's been through trauma.
I think that you can absolutely glean that just from the way Ailee reacts to Oscar and reacts to his bullies, you know, because you can also tell in Ailee, like, you know, she is both a bully and a victim. But you can tell sort of through her trauma, she has sort of had to learn to stand up for herself. You know, obviously she's, you know, you sort of get the idea that she's escaped from whatever she's escaped before, because there are a lot of scenes where she's also like very powerful, you know, especially in the way that she deals with Hawken. Like, she's kind of mean to him. She's kind of mean and bosses him around. But you can see that there is like a power in her. You can see her power plays. You can see in that very first scene that she appears, I think, on the playground. And it's so such a small thing, but the way she jumps off of that jungle gym thing, it just very a smooth jump to the ground. There was something about that. I was like, oh, you're in charge. You are always in charge.
Yeah, I think like I Care a Lot, there's a lot of these playing with the suppositions of the audience, right? Like when we watch films, we read stories, we're looking for someone who stands in for us, right? Like, who would I be in this story?
Yeah.
And it's like both of them sort of refuse they refuse to give you that easy answer, right? Because like, if you identify with Oscar, you're also kind of identifying with someone who is not okay. You know, like that person, like you said, is a serial killer in the making.
Yeah.
He is not okay, which is going to work out great for Ailee, truly. Just made that connection. I'm like, you know what? Never mind. It's great.
Right. It does. It absolutely makes sense for her. But they, like, definitely are, like, but I think that, yeah, they definitely set it up so that it would be okay for Ailee. You know, just sort of, like, listen, Oscar's not innocent. He's, like, cutting out clippings of murders. He's, like, doing his, like, knife play all the time. He starts, like, he's taking weight training classes. You know, he's, like, he is definitely moving towards death.
Yeah, I think it's. They're just both such interesting films, and I love the way that we've talked about. I mean, Sarah's absolutely right. It is queer villains, but it's also queer villains, like villains. You know, and it's like, that's what makes it so fascinating. You know, like Ailee's,
right? Because it's also like queer villains.
Exactly.
Is someone still a villain if they wear a really nice pantsuit?
Oh man, I was like. I love all of these power suits.
Your pantsuits. Oh, they torture me still.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I would say Let the Right One In, not as invested in fashion.
True.
Cool.
Still had a good look to the movie.
Yeah, had a good look because definitely, I mean, I like when kids look like kids, you know.
Yes. It's nice that they're not like 17-year-olds playing 12-year-olds. Yeah.
Right.
No,
totally.
No pantsuits.
Absolutely. I love the sort of, you know, small town vibes in the winter. Everyone's sort of loosely in coats, which like I can't tell how cold it is because like a bunch of people don't have their jackets zipped up.
Yes.
And I was like, is it cold? Is it not cold? I need you to tell me. But still, also good colors. Like the red, the blood red was always like a real strong vibes. Ellie's eyes is a big deal. I think there's a lot of, maybe I'm just noticing because I watched both of them so close together. I was like, oh, a lot of like close-up shots of like intense looking, like intense stares.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like that.
Yeah, it's fun. I you know, I don't think these are a pair of films that everyone would compare on their podcast. But I really found that watching, and I watched Let the Right One In, and then I watched I Care a Lot. There were so many things that clicked for me about each of them as I sort of thought about them in conversation with one another. Yeah. And I think it's so nice that, you know, I have lots of complicated feelings about Marla's death at the end of I Care a Lot. But I really love that at the end of Let the Right One In, the kids get away, you know? Like, I really want that for them, you know?
And they're like, kiss.
Yes.
It's so cute.
Yeah. Oh, that was so sweet. It was like, I can't believe, I mean, I say this all the time about horror movies that I really like, but I'm like, that was so cute. Like,
that was like, really so cute. Sweet.
It was like the sweetest, cutest vampire movie.
The part that made me be like, am I a monster? Is when she had to kill that guy who was coming into her house to kill her. And so like she has blood all over her lips and then she kisses Oscar. I was like, that's real cute. And then he's got blood on his mouth. I'm like, is it cute? Am I being a monster here? I don't know, but I love it, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean, come on. When she kills the bullies in the pool, we were all there. We were all like, that fucking rules.
Yeah. Kill those bullies.
Yeah, it did rule.
And just for Oscar, who's like so isolated and so alone, and like even his relationships with his parents are so tenuous, you know, it's
right,
just
right.
To have someone who really cares about him, right? Because she's left at this point. She's like, I have to leave or I'll die.
Yeah.
And the second there's a serious threat to him, she's like, well, fuck that. I'm here, baby. I got you. And I'm like, oh, I love it.
Yeah. Did you guys wonder how he carried that box onto the train? Or like, logically, I was like, how is this 12-year-old boy pushing this human-sized, like, luggage onto the train? Is someone helping him? These are things I don't have to think about, but I'm just like...
No, I was like, is no one going to ask about the human-sized box traveling with a 12-year-old child by himself? Like, that was my moment.
Yeah, it's just like, just by himself. I mean, I'm glad for him. I want this for him.
Maybe it's a midnight train, so she walks on, and then, like, she gets in the box. I don't know.
Yeah, and then is it, like, is he going to get a job now?
Like, is he going to try and kill people? He's, like, so little. I don't think he's going to be great at it.
That would be a fun sequel. It's just them, like, Oscar at the age of 13.
I kind of see it like a Fargo kind of almost like a buddy cop, but they can't quite figure out how to kill people. They're like, oh no, he's bleeding everywhere. Oh god, they're not gonna let me make that movie, but that's the sequel I would make.
That is the sequel that we need. I need to know how this prepubescent, like you know, preteen boy is gonna take care of this like 100-year-old vampire.
Oh man. Oh, good stuff.
That's the only plot hole.
We're like, we need more information. They're like, the film's over. Just stop asking. I never saw the American remake. Did you all see it?
Yes.
What'd you think?
Sarah, did you see it?
Yeah. I mean, it's even less like the book, right?
It's even less, yes. Yeah.
Even less like this movie. You could just watch this one, honestly. Like, the 2008 one is what you need, I think.
Right. Yeah, I agree. You don't have to watch the remake. I think it's fine to watch at least once, you know, if you're a fan, you want to just keep watching this story in a different, mm-hmm. in a different version of the story.
With a bigger budget, right?
With enormous
American Hollywood budget.
Absolutely. And yeah, and it's such a prime example of the way Hollywood remakes movies, because it does feel like it takes all the queerness out of the original, which already sort of was taken a little bit out of the book. It is very shiny CGI. It's very straight.
Yeah. More moral, like there seems like more of a morality to it as well.
Absolutely,
where you're just kind of like, well.
Yes. It's definitely less quiet. even though a lot of the shots seem very like shot for shot, where I was like, oh, so you do you just watch the other movie, but then just took, you know what I mean? Like, it's definitely like, oh, so you have seen the first one. I don't know why you wanted to make this again. I will say it's not the worst remake I've seen, you know.
Right.
I did find it. I feel at least they did stay somewhat true to the story of the relationship between the two. Although in the new movie, in the remake, they rename her to Abby, which is like, I thought was weird. I was like, they could have just kept the name Ellie, you know, or something more, whatever. But so I don't know why they, I mean, I know why they changed it to Abby. but it was, yeah, I don't know. It was fine. It's not, it's whatever. Is that's my review. It's whatever.
Just fine, thanks.
I'm like, saw it. Don't need to watch it again.
I'm reading the Wikipedia description.
No more water for me. I'm about to leave. Like, I'm packing up. Not again. All right. Yeah.
Amazing. Wow. What good movies. I'm so glad that, I mean, thank you for being here. It is like such an absolute pleasure to speak with you. I love a film lover.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. This was so fun. And I didn't think that these two movies made sense when I accidentally said them together. But now I'm like, oh no, these two, this should always be the double feature when I tell people, like, you have to watch Let the Right One In, and then I care a lot.
Yeah. Like, unlikely double feature, that's where it's at. Yeah,
absolutely. You can, there are so many, if you really think about it, there are a lot of parallels. You could really see it.
Yeah, totally. So, where can people find you online if you want them to find you?
I do. Please come find me on the internet. I'm on Twitter at @TuyetWen. I am on Instagram at @TheTuyetWen. Also, please, I don't want to say please listen to my podcast, but you can also listen to my podcast.
Please listen to the podcast. Tell us the name again. Please, and where can we find listen it?
To any podcast. It is Bunk237. You can find us on Twitter at Bunk237 or on Instagram at Bunk237Pod. But you can find us, like this podcast, wherever you find them, just out in the world. You know, you know where to find stuff.
Yes. And also, I'm about to be on talking about 30 Days of Night yesterday.
Topical. Great timing. Yes. If you love Sarah Sentry like we do, please listen to ours. She's going to be on talking about 30 Days of Night. We're going to talk more vampires, different outfits. Different outfits. Yeah.
Much straighter. Yeah. Much straighter.
Much straighter. Yeah. Very, very straight. Yeah. There wasn't a lot of, they should have been more gay in 30 Days.
The gayest part was me watching it.
I'm so mad when vampires aren't queer. I'm like, listen.
What are you vampires. Doing?
That's exactly how I feel. Like, I think all vampires are queer, right? Like, they're all, right? Like, I mean, that's just accepted. I don't understand why that's not in every single vampire movie.
Your podcast also, you have a co-host.
Her name is Robin Zlotnick, who is delightful.
She is delightful. I was going to concur with what you said. A delight.
I hope Robin's listening to this because I love talking to Robin. Robin and I are new friends. We knew each other before because I'm friends with her husband. But it was actually through us doing this podcast that we've really solidified our friendship. And she is such a great person to talk horror with. She's, we both sort of have similar tastes in horrors, but also, I think sort of overlapping viewpoints, but also we love laughing. We love laughing. I don't know how to say that in a more fun or like, in a more serious way or in a way that like makes you want to listen to me, but wow, do I love laughing. I love laughing.
I feel like I'm always trying to like convince people of that with the pod too. I'm like, it's not just me laughing, but I am the laugh track. Like, that's my job here, you know. Sarah's yeah, says crazy me. Things yeah. and I just like yes. laugh my ass off and I like have to like lay down. I'm like, Sarah, wait, we can't keep recording. I have to like calm yeah. down.
Totally.
It makes me really happy because I just talk and I don't always know which parts are funny. So whenever you laugh, I'm just like
Sarah also like has no idea how to segue, so she'll just be like, yeah. And I'm like, oh my god, it's so funny.
My willful awkwardness, I guess. It's from just like We're in the next place now.
Art. It is art.
You all saw, you heard it at the beginning of the episode, friends. I like dropped something and was like, what?
Oh, Tiet, you are so cool. This was so much fun. We will definitely have to do a more comic booky episode sometime soon. But this is exactly what I needed personally. It was just to like watch two really great films and think too hard about them. You know, I needed to do some reaching, some like projecting of myself onto characters.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me on. I also, one of my absolute favorite things to do is to think too hard about stuff. So like anytime. And I would love to come back anytime to talk about the comic books that I forgot that I liked.
Oh my God. If someone asked me what comic books to read, I'm like, blah, blah. Like, right. I don't, what? What? Yeah. And then I'm like, go listen to my podcast. Bye. Like, yeah. That's not really a sales pitch. I'm like, isn't it though? Stop asking me questions. Go listen to my podcast.
Right.
How to make friends and influence people. Be a dick about your podcast. All right. Thank you, listeners. We love you and we'll be back soon. Hey, listeners. Thanks for being with us here today. Maybe you don't know, but Sarah and I actually run a whole host of projects. This is Essie. Hopefully you know my voice because I probably introduced myself in this episode, but who knows?
Better do it again.
Yeah, why not? And we actually have a publishing house called Queerspec. You can always go check it out. It's at queerspec.com. And that's where we host this podcast, Bitches on Comics, another cool podcast we're working on called Tales of the Sapphire Bay Hotel. If you want to know more, go to queerspec.com. And we have this very cool project called Decoded Pride. Decoded Pride is our story a day anthology of LGBTQ stories by LGBTQ creators. We are selling it because we're an independent series of projects. So everything that we fund ourselves. So that means that Sarah and I are out here hustling as freelancers. We're making money and sending it right into our other projects. And also eating sometimes. Sometimes.
Ramen.
Delicious. So Decoded Pride is amazing. I mean, we have so many stories by so many diverse voices. We have so many gender variant authors that we're publishing. We've got comics, science fiction, fantasy, horror, the whole shebang. And if you order right now, you can get our pre-order price. And you can just go check us out at decodedpride.com. Go buy a subscription right now, pre-order it. We want you to be with us reading these stories and helping prove there's an audience for queer stories by queer creators. We're a podcast that is all about making comic books more accessible to LGBTQ folks and women. So if you have a question about anything related to comics, comic adaptations, pop culture in general, conventions, cosplay, you name it, that's what we're here for. You can send us your questions at bitchesoncomics@gmail.com. Unfortunately, Gmail does not like the word bitch. They're pretty judgy about it. So we can't have it spelled out. It is bitchesoncomics@gmail.com. And do you remember, there's no I'm bitch.
If you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so by rating and reviewing us on iTunes, Spotify, or Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Sarah Century, and you can find me at www.sarahcentury.com and Twitter and Instagram. Still Sarah Century on those.
I'm Essie Fleenor. You can learn more about me at essiefleenor.com. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at @SE_Fleenor.
Bitches on Comics is recorded by Kate Warner, who plays in the band Churchfire. You can find them at churchfiremusic.com. Our music is recorded by Katie Taylor, who plays as Earth Control Pill. You can find her music at earthcontrolpill.bandcamp.com.
Bitches on Comics is recorded in Denver, Colorado. We want to recognize the indigenous peoples who have inhabited and do inhabit this land. The Arapaho Nation, the Ute Nation, the Cheyenne Nation, and others who have been erased from our history and collective memories through colonization.